The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Of oppression.
Britain can do better than this. We're Britain. We're better than this.
September is a crazy month for British politics. Traditionally, it's the season when the political parties head off for their annual conferences. These used to happen by the seaside in Blackpool or Brighton, Torquay or Bournemouth. Now they're in the big industrial hubs of Manchester, Birmingham and Glasgow. These are serious times, especially as the repercussions from the Scottish referendum ricochet around the land. To liven things up, two very different authors have chosen this moment to publish political books. Philosopher Roger Scruton investigates what it means to be a conservative, while the indefatigable journalist Andrew Marr sends up the whole political shebang in his debut novel, Head of State. Guess which one was invited to launch their book at 10 Downing Street? Well, Marr's Prime Minister is one of the more sympathetic characters in his satire, as is revealed in this scene.
Away from Parliament, he'd loved women and abandoned them, and loved and lost his own children, even as his public reputation swelled. But now he felt weary. It was late on Friday afternoon, but that hardly explained it. The PM, by now even he thought of himself as the PM, was a tough old bird. In his veins flowed not ordinary blood, but vim. Vintage sparkling vim, with a splash of Premier Cru gusto. Like any good politician, he was best known to the public for a handful of trivial public sayings and his occasional failures, while his real achievements remained largely hidden. His flashy wit and easy repartee, which had been evident ever since he was a young sub-lieutenant, made Prime Minister's questions considerably more entertaining than they had been under Brown or Cameron. His swift brutality in dispatching incompetent ministers and appointing lesser-known names kept the bloggers and the news sites on their toes. His louche private behaviour, which the Guardian editor had told him privately came dangerously close to sexual harassment, had so far caused him no problems with the electorate. What, in essence, had been his real achievement in office? It was certainly profound, but it was hard to define. It had been to consider the deeper historical shifts, to nudge his country with subtle changes of emphasis away from the rocks. He rarely fought on the brightly lit daily battleground of U-turns or passing scandals, but hung like a shrewd, vigilant old buzzard high overhead.
Head of State is set in 2017, where another referendum campaign is nearing its climax, this one about whether or not to stay in Europe. Andrew Marr has written thoughtful books about political history, but he has no hesitation in admitting that in this instance, he's not taking himself too very seriously. Not for him the rat race of the Booker Prize, or any other for that matter.
No, it's not really what you might call a proper novel in that sense. It's not Ian McEwan or Martin Amis or anything like that. It is, as I've called it, an entertainment. It's there to make people laugh, maybe think a little bit more about politics, but I'm not a serious, heavy, real novelist, and we both know it.
I'm really interested in why you've decided to do this. Here you are, you had a stroke last year, you're still chairing your television show, you've got loads and loads and loads of things on the board, and yet you still find time to write a novel.
Well, the thing is that my non-fiction writing, history and so forth, tends to require a lot of research. I spend a lot of time in libraries, a lot of time interviewing people and going out and researching places and people. And after the stroke, I simply couldn't do that. I couldn't really walk. And so I wanted to do something, keep my mind going. And of course, if you make it up, if you just sit on the sofa with a dictation machine, you can do a novel. And that's why I did it, really.
This is the story of a referendum. We have been in the middle of a referendum.
Absolutely.
And you're Scottish, so you must have feelings about this. But this is a Euro referendum.
This is the other referendum, the one that hasn't happened yet, but may well happen, about in or out of Europe. And it seems to me one of those great existential questions facing the British people and the British state, rather like the Scottish referendum, and therefore fit good meat for a novel. I'm surprised one hasn't been written about it already.
The central set piece, which I think I won't be spoiling it for people if I give it away, is right. the death of the Prime Minister in the last 5 days of this referendum campaign.
Yes, so what we have is a referendum campaign where in versus out of Europe is quite evenly balanced. But overall, people think that the country is going to vote to stay in Europe because we have a Prime Minister I would describe as a kind of Tory Jim Callaghan. He's a much-loved old salt who's been around for a long time, ex-naval, trusted, etc. And he's done some kind of deal with the Germans, and everybody thinks it's going to be all right. And then, 5 days before the vote, he dies.
At which point it becomes almost like it stops being a thriller and almost starts being a sort of Whitehall farce.
Well, it's a comedy, certainly. I mean, I wanted to make it comic before I wanted to make it thrilling. You only want to make a book thrilling because you want people to turn the pages, but I always saw this as a comedy about the kind of people I know, politicians, PR people, journalists and so forth. Not the actual people, mostly, but the kind of people I know.
You have a couple of digs at historians that I spotted. One is Dominic Sandbrook and the other is Piers Brendan. What did they do to offend you, or did they?
Piers Brendan, not so much. Dominic Sandbrook had a real go at... He did what I regard as a very unfair review of one of my history books, where he said it wasn't about all sorts of things like cinema and popular culture and so forth. It was purely a Westminster book, which it certainly wasn't. And I thought, you couldn't have read that book and thought that. And I thought it was a real attempt to say, don't read this book, read my book instead, which was out of order. And I thought, I'll get my own back. And I have.
So what you do is his books, which are unread in a library, in the London Library, become the repository for sort of notes of sensitive
That's right.
notes of state.
Well, my idea was that in this day and age, my younger characters, being very literate in the modern world, understand that if they pass texts to each other or voicemails or anything like that, they are quite likely to be overheard, or it's certainly not secure. And we all know, thanks partly to The Guardian, that it isn't secure. And so how they communicate is they're both members of the London Library, which has open book stacks. So they simply send each other the name and title of a book, the author and the title of a book. And the other one will then go into the book stacks, pick out that book, and in there will be the message. Which only works, of course, if someone hasn't taken the book out in the meantime, which is why poor Dominic Sandbrook's books feature so prominently.
You have a novelist figure, a sort of rather monstrous mother, who gets the very last word when she says, for goodness sake, if you want to tell the truth without alienating people, make it into fiction. Yeah. How much is this you making all the politics you know into fiction in a way that's not quite libelous, but almost?
There are lots of stories here that are true, and lots of things that are accurate, which I couldn't have put into a newspaper story or broadcast news report. So, for instance, some of the things that go on in Danskin House, where there's a big high wall upon which people have to walk and threaten to fall off in one direction or another, that's very much closely based on the way Alan Clark behaved at Saltwood Castle, for instance. Another thing that is more accurate than you might think is one of the characters decides to make his fortune by shorting Britain. Not simply by shorting a company, which we know can be done, but by shorting the country. And I researched this in great detail with financial institutions. And if you try to short, for instance, the top FTSE 100 companies or the top of the index, because you know something bad's going to happen to the country, that is illegal, if it's done on the basis of insider trading, I should say. If you know something and you can short companies, you'd end up in jail. However, there is a loophole in the law. It appears. You can short the currency based on insider information and there is no crime involved. I think I've discovered a loophole in the law which a future government might have to close.
And it's not something that's been discussed before. You think this is a discovery you've made in researching this book?
Well, it was something that happened when I was talking to the senior members of a very large merchant bank who'd been talking to their lawyers, and they came back and said, goodness, we've just discovered this. Our lawyers tell you, you could short the currency. That's fantastic. We didn't know this before. And so I put it into the book.
What sort of people do you think will read this? Do you think it will be people who will look for themselves in it? Or do you think it has an appeal for the general populace who might not recognise all the names? There are lots of journalists and political researchers narrowly disguised.
Well, if it's the people who will look for themselves, then I have readership of about 12, so I hope it's rather larger than that. I hope it's people who enjoy a relatively light read about the real world in which they live, which is satirical. They will enjoy, I hope, picking up the clues about who people are or are not, and getting a little bit of an insight into the way Westminster works at its worst.
You have not only done the writing of this book, but you've also, I imagine, drawn the characters for the end and the beginning and the end of the book.
Yes, well, I was reading through sort of one of the final drafts in digital form, and I was reading it through, and I thought, gosh, I've introduced an awful lot of characters into this book. Will people be able to remember who they are? And I thought, I know, I'll draw them out, and therefore that'll give people a kind of aide memoir of the most obvious kind, so they can flick to the beginning and the end of the book and see the way I imagine the characters to look.
So you've got Lord Brisket, who looks rather like Simon Jenkins, who's a Guardian columnist. Is this any...
There have been more bad guesses about Lord Brisket. It's not Simon Jenkins.
Describe
Lord Brisket is a gossipy, very brilliant, rather establishment-minded, tweed-jacketed, enthusiastic historian who becomes the official historian of the referendum campaign and one of my key heroes. And I'm not going to give it away, sufficient to say that I have promised Peter Hennessy it's not too cruel a portrait of him.
Andrew Marr and Head of State is published by Fourth Estate. So will the experts from the Westminster Village think the book's any good? Especially the lobby correspondents, as we used to call them. One of the most experienced is our own Michael White. I caught him about to board the train to Edinburgh, as you would expect. Hello, Michael. I've set you a weekend task of reading Head of State, and I am very interested to know how you found it.
Well, the first thing I found was I'm absolutely astonished that Andy Marr has got time to write these things. He's a decent man and a clever man, but he did have a terrible stroke which nearly killed him, and I was worrying that he was working too hard. He goes around telling everybody he's working less hard, and he is knocking off a novel. I take my hat off to this man. Did I enjoy it? Did surprise me in one general respect, for such a wholesome chap, how cynical he is about things. I didn't expect that.
So, for example, parliamentary rows almost always happen too late is one of the sort of little bon mots. Is that true?
Well, they often happen too late, but it was more the gloom, really. You know, one of his characters ships all his money abroad. The Prime Minister is presented as, you know, the poor sod who's having to keep the country afloat until it completely goes down the tubes. That's not, of course, what the story's about. It's just a jolly romp. I've been enjoying it. It grates a bit. You know, it's the first novel. It's better than I could ever do, but it still grates. You think, oh, no, got that wrong, and got factual stuff wrong as well. And, of course, there's fun in trying to work out who he's talking about because, you know, I know the world he's describing very well.
The big one, and this was actually his parting shot to me as I left the interview with him, was who is Alois Haydon, who's the fixer and strategist, of whom is said he could no more turn down a conspiracy theory than the late Alan Clark MP could turn down a filly.
Well, there are all sorts of people who wander through the inner recesses of Downing Street who could be like that. Haydon Phillips, the man who was Roy Jenkins' mate in Whitehall and permanent secretary and chairman of the National Theatre and did the MP's pay and did the political party's funding review in the hope that he could crack it and failed. He's actually called Haydon too, so maybe there's a clue there. Doesn't quite fit him. He's a farmer in Wiltshire. Some of the others are more easy because Marr actually uses their real names.
Including his own real name. He's always referring to, the Prime Minister was he was in such a state he didn't even manage to get on the Marr show that morning.
Yes, it's a kind of insider's little joke, all these things. Andrew Neil gets a mention. Fraser Nelson, Andrew Neil's little me, editor of The Spectator, turns up as Nelson Fraser. Well, that's not too close, but we think probably he's meant to be a sort of Damien McBride character, Gordon Brown's brilliant but thuggish factotum. There's Alan Johnson pointed out in the Guardian's review, a fella called Reg Dwight from Pinner comes on a phone-in programme. Now, who is he? Gosh, that's Elton John, isn't it? He's from Pinner and he was born Reg Dwight. And so it goes on. The one that screamed out at me, Claire, was Amanda, the fixer at number 10, the gatekeeper. She is so Angie Hunter, Blair's formidable gatekeeper. Of course, the other obvious one is the king is clearly Charlie Windsor. All his little irritating mannerisms and his use of green ink, except Marr says it's black ink. No doubt who the king is meant to be. Self-pitying, self-important, whinging a bit, using funny spidery handwriting. We get the idea to write whinging letters to ministers and give his opinions, easily flattered. No doubt about that. The other one which struck me, the Prime Minister is obviously an idealised character, probably the sort of PM, wise and clever and worldly, Marr would like to have seen, but we haven't had lately.
What party does he belong to?
I assume he's meant to be Labour, but he could be Liberal Tory. He's a nice guy. He's a good guy. the leader of the No campaign is, of course, I think, Barbara Castle, whom Ma will have known as a young political reporter. She's got aspects of Castle, powerful, charismatic, vain, slightly rackety private life. That's interesting. She's a forceful figure. There are lots of good jokes in this book. I've enjoyed it.
There was a nice line about the apartment in Downing Street being substantially remodelled in the time of David and Samantha Cameron with an electric carving knife that had been acquired during the Johnson era.
Well, I get the ho-ho-ho, Boris Johnson, I get the impression that Ma has spent one way or another, he's been an editor, he's been a political editor of the BBC, all sorts of things. He's been in number 10 upstairs and number 11 more than I have, and that's fine by me. So there are lots of little sort of insider's detail about how number 10 works physically in the cabinet office with a sort of one-way pass to let some people in but not other people in, all that sort of thing. So it's very much a sort of good insider's joke, but the rest of us can read it too.
You said that there were some things that you said, oh, that's not right.
Ma talks about speeches being on a Friday night, MP's speeches being issued to the lower press gallery on press releases sides of A4. That stopped 20 or 30 years ago. That's old tech. They're all online now. And he thought, oh, no, he's out of date there. And his investigative reporter, the one who comes to a sticky end, is described as a lobby correspondent. No, I don't think so. There's a didactic quality to it sometimes. He wrote a book called My Trade, Andy Marr, about journalism, and he kind of gives you a little lecture, because he's a good Presbyterian Scot, about the phony nature of a photo opportunity. And you think, so, thanks for that, Andy. Some people won't have known that.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to take 10% off.
Now, enough of frivolity and sitting on the fence. Let's find out what it feels like to be politically serious and on a road less travelled by us at The Guardian.
My journey. It is not unusual to be a conservative, but it is unusual to be an intellectual conservative. In both Britain and America, some 70% of academics identify themselves as on the left, while the surrounding culture is increasingly hostile to traditional values or to any claim that might be made for the high achievements of Western civilization. Ordinary conservatives, and many, possibly most people, fall into this category, are constantly told that their ideas and sentiments are reactionary, prejudiced, sexist or racist. Just by being the thing they are, they offend against the new norms of inclusiveness and non-discrimination. Their honest attempts to live by their lights, raising families, enjoying communities, worshipping their gods, and adopting a settled and affirmative culture, these attempts are scorned and ridiculed by the Guardian class. In intellectual circles, conservatives therefore move quietly and discreetly, catching each other's eyes across the room like the homosexuals in Proust, whom that great writer compared to Homer's gods, known only to each other as they move in disguise around the world of mortals. We, the supposed excluders, are therefore under pressure to hide what we are for fear of being excluded. I have resisted that pressure, and as a result, my life has been far more interesting than I ever intended it to be. I was born towards the end of the Second World War and raised in a lower middle-class household. My father was a trade unionist and a member of the Labour Party, who always wondered whether he had, in becoming a teacher in a primary school, betrayed his working-class origins. For politics, in Jack Scruton's eyes, was the pursuit of class war by other means. Thanks to the unions and the Labour Party, he believed, the working class had begun to drive the upper classes into the corner from where they would be forced to deliver up their stolen assets. The major obstacle to this cherished outcome was the Conservative Party, which was an establishment of big business, property developers and landed aristocrats who were hoping to sell the inheritance of the British people to the highest bidder and then move to the Bahamas. Jack regarded himself as locked in a lifelong struggle with this establishment on behalf of the Anglo-Saxon peasantry whose birthright had been stolen 1,000 years earlier by the Norman knights. It was a story that he found confirmed in our school histories, in the socialist tracts of William Morris and H.J. Massingham, and in his own experience of childhood in the slums of Manchester, from which he had escaped to one of the remaining bits of Old England in the vicinity of the River Thames. There, thanks to a crash course in teacher training, he was able to settle down with my mother, whom he had met when they were both serving with RAF Bomber Command during the war. And his love of Old England grew in him side by side with his resentment at the aristocrats who had stolen it. He believed in socialism not as an economic doctrine, but as a restoration to the common people of the land that was theirs.
Did you recognise that voice? It belongs to the right-wing contrarian the left love to hate, Roger Scruton no less, reading from his new book How to Be a Conservative. As an eminent left-wing Scottish journalist confided during his recent visit to the Edinburgh Book Festival, however vehemently you disagree with him, it's hard to dislike him. What I wanted to know was how much is this a political treatise and how much is it the story of his own spiritual journey?
The journey to being a conservative is one that I accomplished quite early in my life. I was brought up in the 60s. I'm a member of the baby boom generation. And I was converted to conservatism by 1968 in Paris, observing the anarchic and contemptuous behaviour of the students then. I read the stuff that they were reading. I tried to come to grips with their ideas. And I came to the conclusion that whatever they believed, I was on the opposite side. But my subsequent journey has sort of taken me much deeper into, if you like, an attempt to understand Western civilization and what it is that distinguishes it from so much else in the world, and also the religious experience which is at the heart of it.
That portrait that you drew of your father at the beginning is very affectionate, but then you, against it, you posit one line from Robert Conquest, the right-wing historian: "Everyone is right-wing in the matters he knows about."
Yes.
Bang goes Dad. How much is this an Oedipal struggle you're involved
well,
in?
I don't believe in that Oedipus stuff. I don't think that dismisses him, because, on the contrary, he really did know about some very important things. My father taught me not only to love nature and the countryside, but also to love architecture and the architectural inheritance that we English are still lucky enough to possess. So one of my most important influences in my life, or most important interests in my life, which is the study of architecture and the love of beauty, came from him. I think he was, of course, mistaken in his class warrior politics, but I also understand exactly why he moved in that direction, well, why he inherited that feeling.
Mm-hmm. So conservatism in that sense is about the conservation of the good.
Yes, of course. I agree that it's about what its name suggests. And you only want to conserve those things which you think to be good. You might be mistaken in thinking that they're good. But the point of Robert Conquest's remark is that if you really do think them to be good, you're already on the path to understanding them, trying to separate those things which you really want to conserve from those things which you think of as trash or dross.
The structure of it is interesting, because you have a whole series of sections, which is the truth in the things you don't believe in. So
yes,
you have the truth in environmentalism, the truth in liberalism, and goodness, even the truth in socialism. Mm.
I suppose that was a rhetorical device, but also there's a reason for this, which is that, unlike so many of the isms, I don't think of the conservative position as an ism. You know, it's not, as it were, a system of abstract ideas from which political conclusions follow by logic or anything like that. It is an attempt to hold on to things that you love, cherish and value. And those things are essentially concrete, not abstract. They can't be summarised in a set of principles. But nevertheless, modern politics, for many different reasons, has espoused these abstract formulae, you know, all the isms, socialism, liberalism, etc. So I thought I'd better go through them all and extract what is good in them and show why they don't amount to a complete or cogent political position.
Can we just drill down a little bit into the socialism-ism?
Yeah.
You say mutual dependence and the need to spread the benefits of social membership to those whose own efforts do not suffice to obtain them.
Hmm.
That is the truth of socialism.
Well, roughly speaking, yes.
Which is a good thing, isn't it?
Of course. This is what socialism taught us. We don't live in small communities anymore. We live in a big society in which we are mutually dependent upon each other. Some lose out, some are unable to participate in the same way. And we've all come to recognise this, I think, in a process of quite rapid development since the early 19th century right through to the modern period, that therefore you have to look after people who are not going to benefit from their own efforts. Otherwise, you are fragmenting the loyalty on which the whole community depends. So I take it that this has been established and we can't anymore stand against socialism as though this were some kind of fraud. This is what we all must accept.
But then you're very hostile to many of the institutions that have been set up to safeguard that principle.
I don't think I'm hostile to the institutions. I think many of them have gone wrong. Insofar as I touch on the institutions involved, the National Health Service is something which I think certainly must exist. Whether it is organised in the right way now is a big question. I think we all have that question because we've seen how it is not capable of dealing with the rapid demographic changes that we are now undergoing. Same with the state educational system. I'm totally in favour of it because I'm a beneficiary of it. But again, I think it depends how it is run. I think it has been badly run. In thinking about this, I think one must be very careful to distinguish institutions which are under the control of the state and which are in some way part of the political process, and that is true of the health service and the education service and so on, from institutions which grow spontaneously from people's desire from them. And those, if you like, civil society institutions are to me absolutely fundamental. One must always create the space for them to, as it were, grow anew.
I mean, if we're talking education, you'd be in favour of free schools more than authority-run state schools.
I'm in favour of free most things. If you mean by free schools, schools which have been freed from control from above so that the teachers and the parents and all others with an interest in the product can shape it to their own requirements, then I am in favour of free schools.
But it's free governance of schools that has led to the problems in Birmingham, for example, with radicalisation, which you would be hugely against.
Nothing,
so how do you square that?
You can't square everything. This is what everybody knows about freedom. If you offer it, it's bound to go wrong. So you have to have corrective devices. You have to have things like inspection of schools. This has been recognised from the beginning. You have to have a shared set of expectations and also a curriculum which is answerable to the needs of the public as a whole.
One of the issues you do touch on quite a lot in this is the multiculturalism. Mm. And you say that society should be based on a community of ethnically similar people who know each other, with the nation-state being the largest acceptable grouping. Have I understood you right?
I don't think I say ethnically similar. In the chapter on the truth in nationalism, I'm talking about the way in which people identify with their neighbours and with the surrounding community, its history, its boundaries, the sense that this is where we are and this is ours. You know, that sentiment is incredibly flexible and it has grown under pressure from historical circumstances, and it is what we have by way of a shared loyalty. We don't share a religion anymore. We never shared a racial identity or anything like that. But we do share this. It's something that has been fought for and defended, and it goes with certain other things like a shared language, a way of life, you know, what expectations in day-to-day life, and a curriculum in education and so on. And I say that you've got to hang on to this because it's all that's left. And if you don't hang on to this, you'll find that people start identifying themselves in some other way, either through their religion or through their race or their ethnic identity or whatever it is, and then you get the sort of fragmentation that you've had in Yugoslavia and that we're seeing now in the Middle East.
You talk about the United States in very positive terms. You say it has shown that nothing more is required of the immigrant than the adoption of the civic culture and the assumption of the duties implied in it. And that's a very huge range of different, a geographically big area and a range of different peoples, which works. So why are you so against the idea of a European Union?
I'm not against the idea of a European some kind of community established by treaty among the nations of Europe. I totally agree with Charles de Gaulle's view that we need a Europe of nations, but that means they have to be nations. The mass migration that the European Union is fostering is, to my view, a recipe for disaster, especially for us. For us, it's a disaster because we speak the only international language, so all the migration is one way. I agree with what Nigel Farage says. You know, 470 million people have the right to live in this country, in this tiny island now, and they're coming. We won't be able to sustain what we have if we can't control it. I think this is true of all the European countries, that mass migration is going to be harmful to them. In America, you know, it was assumed in the beginning that we've got all this space, there's one language that you're going to speak. Okay, Spanish has crept in as well, but nevertheless, there's no problem about communication. And once you're here, there's no going back. So there is a completely different situation there. And I think people haven't addressed what it is that they really want out of the European Union. People in England, it's fine, maybe someone in Luxembourg, like Mr. Juncker, has addressed this problem, because what he wants from the European Union is what Luxembourg has always had, namely non-existence as a nation state. But what we had, which was existence as a nation state, indeed the only nation state able to fight for its independence in the last war, is something that we want to hold on to.
You quote Nigel Farage there. Does Nigel Farage come within your definition of conservatism?
He's a person of conservative instincts, clearly, and that's why he's popular. He's not a sophisticated conservative like me, but as I say in the passage I wrote, sophisticated conservatives are very few and living in a dangerous situation. He has the good luck of being an ordinary beer-drinking bloke.
Several times in this book you say that you don't think elections are essential to democracy. That's sort of beyond traditional conservatism, isn't it?
It's not about everything that there should be elections. That's really what I'd want to say. Of course, we are lucky that we do have an electoral system for appointing the principal officers of government, because at least that means we can throw them out. But when it comes to scientific bodies, churches, theatres, anything in which the various patterns of human excellence are revealed, then elections are not what it's about. You don't get the right thing by voting for it. You do, however, get it by people competing with each other and forming networks.
If we move on to the economy, you say that private ownership and free exchange are necessary features of any large economy. Mm. You also say when production and distribution are fixed by a central authority, the economy breaks down with queues and gluts and shortages. Mm. But we've got queues and gluts and shortages, haven't we?
I'm sure we have, but not on the scale that I witnessed in Eastern Europe under communism. You know, there's bound to be these hold-ups where adjustments haven't been made at the same pace in one place as they're being made in another. Everybody knows that, and things smooth themselves out. In that passage, all I was doing was rehearsing the argument, which I think is now widely accepted, of the Austrian economists for thinking that without free exchange, there is no way in which economic information can transmit itself across a society so that even government action will not have a predictable result. So that was my view, in my view, the truth in capitalism. But it doesn't follow from that, of course, that everything must be privately owned, or that there can't be government intervention in the economy to rectify abuses and all the rest. Because that is where I want to withdraw a little bit from capitalism.
Going on to the positive things you posit, you use this phrase, the first person plural. Mm. So a striving towards the first person plural in nationhood, in society, the we, I.
Yes.
But there are so many different we's now. I don't see how that is possibly a realistic formulation.
I suppose I ask the question, what are we going to do about the Islamic State, the new caliphate? This question was discussed in Parliament yesterday, and both Ed Miliband and David Cameron spoke in the first person plural. As to what we are doing, are we threatened by it? Is there an action that we can take? What is it that has gone wrong that we are producing people who are citizens of this country who are fighting against us? This is the first person plural I'm talking about.
And the other transforming thing you mentioned, which you also talk about in The Soul of the World, is your idea of beauty.
Conservatism, as I'm describing it in this book, is a modern product. It arose out of the Enlightenment, hand in hand with the Romantic movement, arose from the recognition that many things are under threat. Things are changing rapidly, that there are values that we have not fully reflected upon and have not fully integrated into our sense of what the future should be. It's up to us now to stand back and look at these things and incorporate into ourselves those things that we value. And I think that the first thing that came to people's mind in the late 18th century and considering these questions was the idea of beauty. What is going to happen to the beauty of the world when it is entirely spoiled by industrial production? This was a hugely important question in 19th century England, as important as the equal question, you know, what is going to happen to human kindness when people are exploited in the way they're being exploited in the factories? And you see this in Ruskin, for instance, who's one of the great heroes of political thought. He called himself a Tory, but he's claimed by the socialists. You know, he's one of those people who simply was trying to articulate what is at stake. Going back to my father, one of the things that joined us together was this our combined attempt to defend our little bit of England from the ruination of speculative building and trying to articulate a rival conception of how things should be done so that people could still be at home in their environment and still love it as they should.
The inimitable Roger Scruton and How to Be a Conservative is published by Bloomsbury. If you want to take issue on any of the points he or anyone else raises, you can do so on our podcast page at theguardian.com/books. Do subscribe on iTunes or SoundCloud, as we have lots of great programmes coming up this autumn. For now, from me, Claire Armistead, and for the last time from our producer, Tim Mabey, who's retiring after 50 years in the business, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.